We're really excited to open today with Scott Mayer from AT&T. Scott is the Senior VP of Technology Planning and Engineering, and a great way to open our conference. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a few minutes to do this. I know what you love, the
All
safe
right.
harbor.
Yeah. we'll start with the safe harbor statement. So some of my comments may be forward-looking and subject to risks and uncertainties, and results may differ considerably. So if you want more information, you can find it on our website or in our SEC filings.
Great.
So with that, homework number one, done.
Terrific. So Scott, maybe I'll just start with an open-ended question. You've been busy. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in your world at AT&T?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much going on right now, Jennifer, I mean, across multiple fronts. When you look at it, I mean, if you like to be busy, it's the right place to be, which I like to be busy. So you look at what's happening with unlimited plans, data growth in, across the networks. You look at the LTE roadmap capabilities that are being rolled out across the nation. You look at what's going on with FirstNet. So we'll talk a little bit about FirstNet today probably and what that means and a level of activity that we're going through right now to gear up for FirstNet. And, of course, 5G, you know, topic of the day, a lot going on in that space with planning, testing, standards. We're involved in all of it in very deep ways. And, then, of course, spectrum, right? Yep. Spectrum underlies it all, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot going on in the spectrum space as well in the industry and also for AT&T and things we've been doing. But the other thing that is really driving a lot of our work every single day is what we call our software-defined networking initiative. So it's wireline and wireless. It doesn't matter. And what that really means and how we're implementing that is the other thing we're spending a lot of time on, I'm spending a lot of time on. So like I said, if you like to be busy, it's a great place to be because there's no dull moments.
I'm sure your days are long and your travel frequent. But maybe you touched on spectrum. So if we could talk about your current spectrum position. You know, a lot of debate. Davis just put out a great spectrum report yesterday. I think gave T the most valuable nod. If you can talk a little bit about where you sit now, do you need more? If you wanted more, where would it be? Low, mid, high band, ultra high band?
Sure. So, you know, I'll just start with what's happening and why spectrum is so important. So, if you just look at capacity and, you know, what's going on with unlimited data and data traffic. So you've heard us talk about the amount of data traffic over the last 10 years, right? 250,000%. Video continues to be the heavy load on the network. And we're greater than 50%, easily greater than 50%, and growing rapidly. In fact, last year, we saw video growth grow by 75% as measured by gigabytes on the network. So as an industry, we always hear that 75 to 80% of video, of the data on the network in the next 5 years is going to be video. We're seeing it play out. I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing. And so it's our responsibility to keep up with capacity. So we always watch network performance, right?
Mm-hmm.
You always know if there's a problem. So performance is really good on our network right now. Reliability is at all-time high. And the capacities and such are in a really good space. And we really owe it to the spectrum position we have, right? Probably the best spectrum position in the industry. In fact, not probably, is the best spectrum position in the industry. As also you know, noted in your report, we're in a very good space yesterday. And in your information, we implemented some things to help manage spectrum and manage capacity with StreamSaver earlier this year. So network management techniques like that are really paying benefit. But again, the most cost-effective way to deploy capacity is through spectrum. And so that's why that spectrum position is so important. And when you look at other LTE capabilities that I mentioned, improving spectral efficiency, improving performance of the network on the LTE roadmap is there as well. So, and then it also starts with the dense network. So, if you will, I'm going to unpack a little bit of that because there's a few details
sure.
underneath each one of those. So, spectrum with 60 megahertz of fallow spectrum, right? That's a lot of headroom.
And that's AWS, FirstNet, WCS, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Those three spectrum bands, the latest being FirstNet.
Right.
And so, what we plan to do is we're going to use the FirstNet build And as we touch the towers to build FirstNet, we're going to put that other spectrum to use. And that's going to put a lot of capacity into the network and build in a very efficient way. We call it a kind of a single touch or one touch approach that when you touch the tower, you're not touching it just for FirstNet, but you're touching it to put other bands of spectrum and other spectrum in service as well. And that, again, I always view an engineer's job is to build high-quality capability with the lowest unit cost. And that's the way you do it. You do it in a fashion like that. So we continue to redeploy 2G and 3G spectrum. That's not new. We do that day in and out. We do it hundreds of times a year. As traffic rolls over to LTE, we'll take spectrum from the 3G network and move it to LTE. And so it's a really efficient way to make use of your assets. And as I mentioned, 4x4 MIMO and the modulation techniques and also carrier aggregation come into play that yields benefits for us. And we'll continue to densify the network as we always have been, right? More macro towers as well as small cells, a key part of our overall program to manage that capacity requirement.
And as you know, there's been a lot of talk on the millimeter wave spectrum, the high 28 to 39 gigs and 39 gigs. You kind of did a great, I thought, a great deal, and I think there's more spectrum to come from fiber tower. Now, straight path went to Verizon.
Correct.
What are your thoughts on millimeter wave spectrum? Because it becomes a large part of the 5G conversation.
Correct. So with our pending acquisition of fiber tower, it's a really good starting spot for us, right? Nearly 400 MHz nationwide of spectrum. It gives us the roadway into 5G that we need. There'll be other opportunities, right? We'll have FCC auctions and other means to acquire anything else we need. But millimeter wave is a part of the roadmap that we're going to have for 5G. And there will be spectrum available. But again, we have what we need now to get into the 5G space and grow it considerably well.
I think we're going to touch on that later. It seems like a good amount's coming from the FCC in terms of inventory. Yep. And you touched on FirstNet, which this is a big topic of incoming calls for so many different sectors we follow. But can you talk a little bit about how FirstNet will play a role in building out your network? I guess the timeline, it's where there was an announcement this week, where we stand now.
Sure. So first off, I'll just say, for AT&T, it's a great honor to build a public safety network that's nationwide to service our first responders. It just is. I mean, first responders do great work impacting our lives and many people's lives every single day, and they need a great network for communications and doing what they need to do. So if you're not familiar with FirstNet, for anybody that might be listening on the webcast, a good public-private partnership, right, involving the U.S. government. Really some key tenets of what FirstNet brings. One is the federal government will provide $6.5 billion of investment over 5 years to go build the network. Along with that investment will be 20 MHz of 700 spectrum.
Nationwide
for us to use to build for first responders. The other aspect of that spectrum is when it's not being used for first responders, AT&T will be able to use it for our commercial business.
I think that's an important point. So it's not just for public safety. I mean, that's obviously the priority and God forbid an event.
Correct.
But it can be shared.
Exactly. Okay. It'll be shared spectrum. And the other aspect is as states opt in, and we'll talk a little bit about the opt-in process here in a minute. As states opt in, they will have access to AT&T's network, our commercial network as it sits today on a priority basis as well. And so as soon as we don't have to wait, first responder organizations don't have to wait to get FirstNet capability. They don't have to wait for us to build before they get FirstNet capability. So they'll be able to use our commercial network. That's the way that we structured our agreement with the U.S. government and the FirstNet organization. So it's a really good public-private partnership, and it will really provide a great capability for states to get in early. So the process. Let me just cover the process.
Sure.
The process itself starts with, in fact, it started this week. We offered state plans this week through a portal, and that kicks off a timer, if you will, of how the process will play out. For the next 90 days, states will have an opportunity to review those plans, provide feedback to us, and then we'll also respond back. So at the end of 90 days, there will be a final state plan that the states will then start the second 90 days.
Okay.
Second 90 days is the decision-making process. They'll have an opportunity to opt in or opt out of the FirstNet network. And if they want to opt in, they'll start taking advantage of AT&T's commercial network for first responder needs. If they'd like to opt out, that triggers a 180-day window where they have to go develop a plan, do an RFP, and then get FCC approval in order to opt out. Now, with that comes a requirement that they have to interface back with the FirstNet AT&T core network.
Okay.
So they'll be responsible for all the interoperability and making sure that it operates correctly so that we maintain a nationwide capability, not state by state. And so that timeline is basically 90 days plus 90 days. It really puts us in, I'll call it the mid-December timeframe for states' final decisions. They can opt in earlier if they'd like. And if they want to opt out, it adds another 6 months after that in terms of the build.
And if they opt in early, if they say, "We're in," could things start moving in a particular state ahead of, or do you wait till kind of that mid-December point?
So we'll absolutely, as soon as somebody opts in, we will start designing and building that network. So we have a design cycle. So we have to figure out what we're going to put on towers and how we're going to align it and build. So realistically, the build may start minimally by the end of the year, but it's really going to be 2018 before but the process, our implementation process, will start right when they opt in.
Got it.
And in the meantime, they'll still be able to get FirstNet capability on our commercial network.
Okay.
So
Interesting.
In other words, the deployment of the spectrum on towers does not gate the ability for states to start using FirstNet capability and services.
Immediately.
Immediately.
Okay. That's an important point. So, Scott, the other thing I want to touch on, because we're at a 5G conference, and I think if you asked an RF engineer, "Give us three words to describe 5G," they might say small cell fiber. And so I wanted to explore both those issues. Maybe first, small cells. It's definitely the buzzword. It's been the buzzword for years, but it feels a lot more real right now. Can you talk a little bit about AT&T's small cell strategy?
Absolutely. So small cells absolutely will play a part in the network. We start with a macro network that's the densest out there right now, and then we'll augment with small cells. Small cells are a great way to provide capacity into areas where it's very difficult to build cell sites and such. And as you build small cells for the LTE network, it pre-positions you for the infrastructure we're going to need for 5G as well. So there's a very good reason why you want to do small cells. And we're busy building. We'll do several thousand this year, and it will be augmenting the macro network as we see it today. And those small cells are really a different type of architecture, and I'll just take a moment and describe that. So small cell architecture, if you think about a cell site, the brains of the cell site are at the bottom of the cell site.
Okay.
And it serves the radios and antennas up on top. So it's one-to-one relationship.
Right.
The term we use in the industry is called C-RAN or centralized RAN. So that unit, the brains of the base of the cell site, are moved back into a centralized location.
Okay.
And then the radios and the small cells, if you will, emanate out from there. So one centralized unit can handle hundreds of small cells being built across the city. And that's what we call a centralized RAN architecture. And it gives us a couple things. One is the ability to upgrade very quickly. It gives us the ability to upgrade because that software happens in one place across hundreds of small cells. Plus, add additional feature functionality very quickly as well. The other thing I would note is all of those small cells are fiber connected. And so it's a requirement that that centralized unit out to the small cell be a fiber-based transport solution. So having fiber and building fiber is a really important part of how you deploy small cells.
So the brains at the bottom of the tower, that's fiber dense. Okay.
Yep.
So that kind of leads to the next question. Maybe, you have, I think, a 21-state ILEC footprint, but a national wireless footprint. So, you've had Verizon talk openly about an out-of-network, ILEC network fiber strategy. What is AT&T's view on that?
So we start with the largest, in fact, it is the largest fiber network. 1 million-plus route miles of fiber is what AT&T owns as part of our fiber assets. That's a really good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
It's both in the 21-state footprint and outside-
Okay.
the 21-state footprint.
Right.
So we have fiber assets in many places that are not in the traditional franchise areas. That fiber network is gonna be required for 5G.
Mm-hmm.
Either the assets we have or assets that we'd find a way through different arrangements, different partners to go acquire. But we start from a position of strength with where we're at. The key with fiber is how you actually deploy it.
Mm-hmm.
So, from an engineering principle, integrating all of your needs as you build fiber is absolutely critical. So we don't, when we deploy fiber, we don't deploy just for a small cell solution or just for a cell site solution. We take the collective needs of AT&T and our collective businesses. What businesses do we want to sell fiber services into? What residential areas or consumer areas do we want to offer broadband at gigabit speeds into? Where do we find the need for small cells in the future? Bringing all those assets together is the way that we build a fiber plan, because the person that's planning that fiber, the most important thing they need to know is the total needs for the area, so they know how many fibers to put in the cable.
Okay.
Yet, why that's important is the cost of a fiber build is not the fiber itself, but the placing cost, the build cost, down streets and down alleyways and through backyards. That's where the cost. You got to get the fiber sizing right. We've been doing that as part of our DIRECTV merger acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Been putting a lot of fiber into the network. We had a requirement of 12.5 million homes passed. Been making great progress on that. We're a little over 5 million now. We'll be over 6 million by the end of the year, and well on track to hit that requirement. And that's a key step because we're driving fiber deeper into the network.
Yep.
Deeper, deeper, deeper. So where those small cells are, we're gonna be that much more closer. Where the next business opportunity is, we're gonna be that much closer. And so the economics of fiber are that as you build deeper, the next need is incrementally cheaper-
Mm-hmm.
and quicker to do, because that business that I wanted to offer fiber services to, that might be 1,000 feet away today.
Right.
When I do that job for a residential or broadband consumer capability, maybe I'm only 500 feet away from that business now.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time I deploy fiber, I'm getting closer and closer, and the next job is cheaper and quicker. And so it builds on itself.
Even outside your ILEC network?
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
'Cause I think there's, there might be some perception that Verizon, given its announcements, is a lot more serious about fiber, but that from what I'm hearing from you, fiber for sure is a, where you said, an extreme priority. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We keep building fiber and will. It's needed for multiple reasons inside of AT&T.
Got it. Great. We also touched on the towers, and I wanted to kind of dig deep a little bit there, 'cause there's also been, I would say AT&T has been one of the more vocal carriers about the tower model and, maybe some changes that you'd like to happen. Can you talk a little bit from where you sit? I think AT&T has 60,000 towers. Am I right on that number? How do you see the towers playing a role in 5G? If you had a wish list of what you could change, what would that be?
So, I'll start with, yes, we have been very vocal, and the term we've used is unsustainable. And the way I would characterize it is, anytime you see a cost stream in a business that's growing faster than the business itself-
Mm-hmm.
You have to take a look at it.
Sure.
You have to look at the business model and say, "What needs to change here?" And that's what we've actively been doing. And the model that we have today, from a lot of the major players, is one that when the analogy we've used is renting an apartment. When I rent the apartment, I'm paying a rental fee. But when I want to buy a new TV and bring it in, a new bedroom set and bring it in, I have to pay incremental dollars on my rent and keep paying. So the rent keeps going up. And the model we're moving towards, that we want to move towards, is what we call a real estate model. We want to rent or lease square footage or square inches on a tower, and within that space on the tower, be able to do what we need to do for our wireless infrastructure. So we'll put up new equipment, take down equipment, and of course, being limited by the structural requirements of the tower, right? I mean, that's a given.
Of course.
But we want to rent the space on that tower and be able to use it freely. And we've been working with and are starting to work now with some new partners that are subscribing to that model, a real estate model with a better set of economics. We're talking with our current vendor tower partners around that model as well. And we hope we can get there as well because that model sets us up on a more sustainable path. And with the partners that we have that are using that new model, we're going to be allocating sites to them. FirstNet's going to be some new build that we're going to have as part of that plan. And as new terms, as the terms come up, right, lease terms come up, there's always an opportunity for us to evaluate what we want to do next. And those are thousands over the next few years that we have an opportunity to evaluate. But we just want to get to an economic model that is more in line with what's happening in the business.
There's been a history where you've dealt with some of the public tower companies where they seem to, for lack of a better word, play ball and give you rights to the tower. Is that kind of the kind of the conversation you'd like to have?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly the model.
Okay. Got it. So we are at a 5G conference. And we learned from your Chief Strategy Officer, John Donovan, of course, that 5G is kind of being thought of really more a two-tranche technology build. Can you dig a little bit more on that and offer some thoughts on that, Andrew?
Sure. So 5G, there's a lot going on in that space across multiple fronts, lots of trials and standards. But I'm going to start with what we call our 5G evolution plan and describe what that is. We've said that this year, by the end of this year, we'll have, we call it 5G evolution, but it's really application of LTE Advanced and LTE Pro capabilities for higher speeds for LTE, so at least twice as fast as a traditional LTE network. And so those cities are being built. We have two that are live right now, one in Austin and one in Indianapolis, and we're seeing really nice performance out of those two cities. In fact, I saw some data earlier this week that was released, some public data around some of the competitive speeds. And Indy and Austin looked really, really nice from my perspective, given the work we've been doing there. And so that's a sign of things to come in terms of how those markets will play out. And ultimately, in Austin and Indy, we'll also be deploying later this year four-way carrier aggregation, and again, another LTE roadmap capability, and also LAA, which is unlicensed spectrum, if you will, in those markets. So we'll get up to close to a gigabit per second peak speeds, theoretical peak. And so I always like to describe what that means. It's theoretical peak. In reality, what customers will see is 10%-20% on average of what those theoretical peaks are. So that's still 100 or 200 megabits per second on a smartphone, and that's smoking fast. And that's what the LTE roadmap gives us. So that's the way we're moving into and evolving into 5G. But with respect to 5G specifically, there's, like I said, a lot of trials going on, a lot of tests going on, a lot of standards work. So I'll kind of take them a little bit at a time. So we've shared our tests that we've done in AT&T Labs with gigabit speeds or 10, 12, 14 gigabits per second speeds, single user. So the technology is there. It works. I've been in demonstrations riding around in vans and seen five, six, seven gigabits per second in terms of capability. So that's real. That's real. The other thing that we're going to be doing in the next two, 3 weeks is we're going to be starting a trial in Austin, multiple locations, multiple devices with multiple customer types. So residential customers, small business customers, enterprise customers. And using DirecTV Now, we're really going to load up the capability on 5G to understand the performance characteristics, things that we need to understand for standards. So those standards are important. So all the data we got out of those trials folds back into standards work so that the industry gets a good set of standards that we can all build to. And we've been very active. They're probably one of the, in fact, we are the largest contributor to standards, the 3GPP,
yep.
5G standards.
We very much have a seat at that table.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And largest contributor in the U.S. actually of standards. And that's the way we do it. We do it through that trial data. So that'll tell us more. So the way the standards are going to play out, there's a lot of clarity now, mm-hmm. I think, on how 5G actually comes to market. 3GPP earlier in this year in March took release 15 that was scheduled for June of 18 and made a decision to pull forward the hardware and chip standards that need to be out, that will be out by the end of 17. So the long pole in the tent is usually the hardware and the chipset development. So those standards will be out at the end of 17. So that's called like an early release, phase one early release. The full phase one standards will be out mid-18 from 3GPP, so maybe as early as June, we hope. Those standards will dictate fixed wireless as well as mobile standards for the industry. So that's kind of the next, and that's the key ones because that's what everybody wants to get into is fixed wireless and mobile capability. So that's June of 18.
Okay.
That then sets the stage for what will be early introduction of 5G in a commercial space, standards-based, which will be...
And then where are we in that time? Where
probably
the,
late 18.
Late 18. Okay, so that's
first
really
part of 19, first half. Yeah, it's
years.
Pulling it forward.
Yeah, right.
It's
I mean,
pulling
I would
it
say
forward.
It was 2020 a year ago.
Correct,
so,
the scale.
Okay.
So we'll see, instead of scaling in 2020, we're going to start to see scaling in 2019, I think, in the commercial space. And the standards work that's been done in that body is what has enabled that to happen. Pulling forward the hardware and getting the standards for mobility and fixed in mid-June of 18. The second phase is end of 19, and that's going to be more focused on massive IoT. Massive by a million IoT devices in a square kilometer. I mean, that's a lot of connected things.
Yeah.
but that's end of 19, as well as more latency or better latency characteristics, higher reliability, things that we're going to need for the other use cases that have been talked about, AR, VR, you know, autonomous cars. A lot of that will come, the standards will come end of 19.
Got it.
But,
okay.
But the mobility and fix is key. So three key dates, December 17 for the hardware, chipset manufacturers, mid-18, June, July 18 for mobile and fixed standards, and then end of 19 for the other massive IoT and other use cases. So that gives us clarity around what's going to happen in 5G better than we've had. And I'll also add that as 5G evolves and gets implemented, the LTE network, as I just talked about, mm-hmm. is going to be really, really quick and fast and provide a lot of capability. It's not going anywhere fast.
Right. Okay.
Right. I mean, it's going to be around a long time. It's going to backstop the 5G network and provide services well into the future for us.
But the fallow spectrum you spoke about earlier will be well in, lit up and by where we get to 5G,
correct.
Right? Okay.
Correct. Terrific. Exactly.
I wanted to just explore AirGig because we've talked a lot about Project AirGig and maybe connecting the dots of how that fits with the small cell 5G strategy would be helpful.
Sure.
And maybe give what it is. So.
Yeah, so AirGig, so that's our term inside of AT&T for a technology capability that's basically a transmission capability using spectrum on power lines. So it's on power lines, not in, not through, but on the surface of power lines. So it's actually a pretty interesting technique. And that capability, multiple gigabit speed capability using AirGig, using the AirGig approach, it will be a really good use case for backhaul, fronthaul service capabilities for small cells, any other transmission where you have aerial power wires. Again, you have to have aerial plant. Or aerial cables for power. It's not limited to 21 states.
Okay.
It's not limited to the U.S. I mean, it's
right.
It's a capability you can use in a lot of places. And with multiple gigabit speeds using existing infrastructure That opens up the ability to quickly deploy and build, you know, transport technologies, you know, in a way that we haven't ever seen before. So, it's early in the development cycle. We're at the point right now that we're gonna be doing two field trials this year with AirGig technology. We need the practical experience of what happens in the real world to plow back into the development of it. And so, we're excited about it. Really good possibilities. We have heavily patented the technology, 200+ patents or patents pending on AirGig for AT&T. And we're gonna stay focused on it. I think it has a lot to offer.
I guess my last question, SDN comes up a lot. And just the way I understand it in the most simplistic sense is AT&T is moving from a hardware company to software. So you're pushing a lot of fiber deeper into the network to push the intelligence over the network. Is that how am I too elementary in that?
No, that's actually a great way to describe it, right? It's taking what had traditionally been what I would call aggregated and heavily integrated hardware and software, splitting it apart so I can virtualize capabilities in software, and I can run it on standard generic hardware.
Got it.
A couple of things. It gives us a lot of flexibility in building new capability quickly in software without having to deploy a lot of new boxes. You know, I can develop a cloud layer platform with servers, and I can run multiple different software capabilities on top. And we're focusing on open source software. We believe it's the way to go. And those functions, we call it, if you hear the term network function virtualization. I simplify it, call it network functions or virtualizing functions. It's like the alphabet to me. It has 26 different functions in it, and each unto themselves, they don't mean anything. But together, when aggregated, they provide finished products and capabilities. So there's over 200 network functions in our network. And so we're virtualizing those functions one at a time. So we had 5.7% of them done in 2015, a little over 34% in 2016, and we'll be over 55% of those functions on our way to our 75% goal by 2020. So little by little, we're virtualizing those functions, and then we're aggregating them or service chaining them together to create capabilities that are used in a network or in finished goods, such as our, you know, some of our network on demand, NetBond capability, FlexWare services that we offer, which is basically a universal CPE or a white box CPE unit that we can put software on and provide routing and load balancing and firewall capabilities on for customers. And we can update it remotely, right? A lot of those capabilities are back in the network. So that gives us the flexibility we need. It changes our cost structure. It absolutely changes our cost structure, both OpEx and CapEx over time. So if I have a function, that's the application. Any good PC, you can't have an application without an operating system.
Right.
That operating system is what we've been calling ECOMP, and has developed 8 million lines of code over the last few years on that. Then earlier this year, moved that into the Linux Foundation as an open source base of code that really will be the network operating system of the future. We want to engage all parties across the world in how we further develop ECOMP. Linux Foundation renamed it ONAP, Open Network Automation Platform. They renamed it that so we can contribute a lot of additional capability from other vendors. So large OEMs are signing up, large operators are signing up, and we hope to have, by the end of the year, 60%-70% of wireless subscribers, the companies that have those wireless subscribers, participating in ONAP by the end of the year.
Wow.
So it's gaining a lot of momentum, and that's exactly why we did what we did.
You certainly have been busy.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
So, Scott, thank you. I hope we can watch DirecTV Now with the Bears beating the Packers one day.
There we go. We had a conversation last night. Take care. Thank you.
That was great.
Appreciate it.
Perfect.